let's start with a bit of Piano Concerto number 21 in C major, Mozart, from the YouTube channel Kasha. We are exploring the world of classical music, how it surprises us, and how to bring it to the masses. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Paul Morley was a music critic covering the rock and pop scene of the 70s and 80s. But as his career went on and streaming platforms took hold, a new world opened up, and he was able to access every piece of Mozart or Bach, anything he wanted. He started to understand classical music in a whole new way. Has your respect for classical changed over time? What do you appreciate about it? Who is your favorite composer? And what do you want to know about their influences? It's 800-642-1234. Paul Morley's new book is called A Sound Mind, How I Fell in Love with Classical Music and Decided to Rewrite Its Entire History. Paul, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. Good morning. Great to hear from you.
Well,
thank
good you. Afternoon to you.
yeah,
as we
so,
reach you in London. Yeah. There was a time that you thought classical was old-fashioned and out of date, but you discovered it was just way ahead of its time, and listening to it is no longer your guilty pleasure. What does classical do for you?
Well, it's a complicated story. I think the institutions, the establishment of classical music, I always found put up a barrier to entry, if you like. You know, so the great kind of iconic names like a Mozart or a Beethoven always seemed very distant and very useless to me as I was growing up. But once I hit my 50s, and as a writer about music, people were still asking me to write about Harry Styles and Taylor Swift. I realized that actually I wanted to discover new music in my own way, another kind of music, you know, classical music being something that suddenly opened up to me because of streaming. I could get access to all this amazing music. And even if it was centuries old, it was new to me. And I guess it's all about being a writer as well. How do you write about music? What's music for? How do you experience music? And so I came to classical music for a number of reasons. And I guess the basic one was, oddly, considering a lot of it is old, was to find new music.
I really appreciate your quote by the late Indian music teacher, Gita Sarabhai. And she said, the purpose of music is to quiet and sober the mind, making it susceptible to divine influences. Does classical music give us that ability to travel outside ourselves? Is it a spiritual experience?
I think absolutely. I mean, once I'd broken through some of the barriers and the opaque nature of the music, you realize that you get in touch with some extraordinary minds from across time, and minds that have dealt with all sorts of crises and catastrophes and are making music for exactly those purposes in a way. I was intrigued, especially after what's happened in the last few months, about a music that had survived so long and had constantly kind of reinvented and repurposed itself, which seemed interesting that whenever there were wars and plagues and these kind of things, classical music found a way to break through, just as music, as not necessarily. I'm not necessarily interested in the buildings and the conventional history of it. I was just interested in the great minds and what they would. And I think what's interesting about the great classical musician, the great musician and the way they think, is that they are anticipating constantly problems, and they seem to navigate and negotiate big changes in life even before they happen. They're anticipating what is about to happen, and so by communing with their minds, you get a better sense of how to deal with your own existence. And especially the last few months, that's become even more apparent that you need to know how to deal with very unconventional, very dramatic, often quite scary circumstances, and a great mind, a great musical mind, can help you do that.
We're talking, if you're just joining us, with Paul Morley. He's been a music journalist for more than 40 years, and his latest book is called A Sound Mind, How I Fell in Love with Classical Music and Decided to Rewrite Its Entire History. You can join in the conversation with what classical music does for you. What do you love about it? What did you start listening to in classical? What are you listening to now in the pandemic? Join in at 800-642-1234. You know, Paul, you say here the pandemic, and I'm wondering, you've been pondering the crisis that orchestras are facing. What challenges do orchestras face amid the pandemic? Will orchestras survive?
Well, I was considering the interesting nature of the orchestra for many years, actually, because I suppose it's always been a kind of folly. It's such a huge, wonderful, miraculous thing. And it certainly at its best makes you believe in the power of art and gives you signs of intellectual life. But obviously, it was always threatened with extinction. And that has been for quite a while, if you think about it, because it's just an unwieldy and impractical thing. And certainly over the last few months, you would think even more so. But what I've learned, certainly from my own exploration of centuries of history of classical music, is that ability it has to adapt and always change. It might not be what we are used to experiencing. It might become something else. But classical music, because it has survived centuries, gives you an optimism for the future, that music and thinking about music and loving music and therefore loving humanity and the future will continue. It gives you a kind of belief that things will happen in the future, because there's been centuries of musicians writing music in the belief that it will last into a future, therefore the future will happen. The orchestra, you sometimes think, cannot possibly survive, especially now with the amount of kind of economic structure it requires. But on the other hand, it has managed to do so for many years. And I think that people always find a way to make things work. They always need this kind of experience as part of their daily lives. I think also what I've started to realize about classical music, you know, if you come to it thinking that it is all about the orchestra and the big symphonies and the concertos, it's also about kind of small, compact, mobile chamber pieces, you know, from the solo to the very few, the string quartets. It doesn't necessarily have to be the big symphonies, the big show-off symphonies. It comes in all forms and comes in various sort of shapes and sizes, so that you can get very intimate, very, very beautiful pieces made by just a single instrument or four instruments or six instruments. So it's got this incredible sort of adaptability, which I think will be very useful as we move into the future and possibly have to deal with what music is and how we experience it in a very different way.
Let's take a call now. Cole is joining us from Sun Prairie. Hi, Cole.
Hello. I just wanted to share a couple of classical music composers that I've really enjoyed over the years. I was a music minor in college, and so I had to take a music history course where I learned more about the Russian composer Tchaikovsky. One of the things I appreciate about him is that his sound is so unique, because the Russians, their style of classical music was so much different from Western music. And plays with a lot of different tones and scales. It's not quite the same as what normal classical Western music was at the time. And then Claude Debussy, I really appreciate a lot of his music, in particular the song Clair de Lune. Has helped me with anxiety, actually. When I have anxiety, that song in particular, I put it on, listen to it, and it's calming. And so those are just some of the things I really have appreciated about classical music over the years.
Oh, Cole, thank you for that call. And I know, Paul, you share that interest in Debussy.
Yes, a huge fan of Claude Debussy for some of those reasons, absolutely. I think because Claude Debussy in his own life is quietening his mind and dealing with anxiety, that comes through his music. And I also found for me that Claude Debussy was also the beginning of modern music in many ways. The way that he was writing his music almost anticipated recorded music. The way that he would use textures and edits and generate a different kind of way of composing music that seemed way ahead of its time. And in the book, you know, there's a huge Claude Debussy playlist, and Claude Debussy is definitely one of the stars of the book.
We're talking with journalist Paul Morley, our guide to the power of classical music and all it has to offer. You can join in. When did you first start listening to classical? How did you come to it? Did someone introduce you to it and help you find composers or eras? 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up in a minute with Paul Morley here on the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
yes, the fourth movement of English composer Gustav Holst's enduring classic, The Planets. A seven-movement suite. This is Jupiter, the bringer of jollity, performed by the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain. We're reflecting on what classical music brings to our world here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have longtime music journalist Paul Morley, who calls Holst the first emperor of the blockbuster universe. What do you love about The Planets? 800-642-1234. Well, The Planets was the first classical album you ever bought as a teenager. How did you hear it as a teenager versus how you listen to it today?
Well, when I was a teenager living in Manchester, you would often be drawn to records that were cheap. Because you could only maybe afford one. It sounds daft now when you can hear all music all the time, all at once. But back then, you know, buying an album a month was about all you could afford. And there was a series of records on a label called Music for Pleasure that you would buy in your local Woolworths for a very cheap price. And I also love science fiction. And the Holst Planets album at that time was always packaged, looking very futuristic. A bit like, say, 2001: A Space Odyssey, and the idea that there were planets on the cover and it looked very space age drew me to it. But what disappointed me with it, and probably put me off classical music, you know, for quite a while, was that it sounded very puny. It sounded very frail, and obviously, rock and pop records always sound so fantastic because they're recorded in such a kind of extravagant way and an innovative way. And classical music tended not to be. So for a while, rather foolishly, I was put off a certain source of classical music, certainly the less experimental classical music, because it didn't sound as powerful and as sexy as pop and rock. And unfortunately, it was The Planets that put me off. But over time, I've learned to understand and love The Planets and the way that that Holst was using the orchestra. And it's been one of those sort of gateways into what was originally a blockage has become a gateway back into classical music for me.
How do you hear filmmakers using The Planets?
Well, I think that was another reason why at the time in the early 70s it sounded wrong, is because it sounded cliched, because oddly enough, yeah, the composers that were using it and stealing some of its ideas for blockbuster movies, obviously eventually John Williams and composers like that with the Star Wars movies, they were using a lot of techniques and styles and dynamics that Holst himself would have been using. And I assumed that therefore Holst was something of a cliche, not really understanding his position as one of the innovators of those sounds, that in fact it was him that came to many of those ideas first. So again, I thought it was rather ubiquitous and a little bit boring sounded because I was used to hearing it in a different context. It happened with a lot of composers in the classical world, actually. Once I realized that in fact many of them have revolutionary minds and themselves are very experimental and innovative, and you crack through the idea that they're from the past and therefore seem dated, you realize that the if you can imagine the times they were living in and how innovative they were, you get a different sort of view of their music, and it doesn't sound as quaint and as remote from your daily life as it once seemed.
Paul Morley with us, a music journalist for decades. His latest book explores the world and history of classical music. It's called A Sound Mind. You can join in with what classical music does to you. 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Tom now in Maguanago. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. Nice to talk to you this morning. I just totally love classical music. Was raised in a household where it was played all the time and kind of revered. I think in the last probably 10 or 20 years, I've really kind of fallen in love with like the French romantic classical music, say like what Berlioz does or what Ravel does. Like Ravel's Le Tombeau de Couperin, the minuet, and that I think is the most beautiful piece of music in the world. And then I just wanted to impart one other thing. It's something, because through a very difficult part of my life, very difficult time, I got into listening to Lakmé, the opera Lakmé, and it brought me through a very tough time, and I will always be appreciative of that.
Tom, thank you so much for those thoughts. Let's hear some of Ravel's string quartet in F major and just take a listen. You devote a lot of time in the book to Ravel. What can you say to Tom here about what he's hearing?
Well, obviously, he's probably hearing something very different from me. I think everybody brings their own experience to what they hear. I absolutely agree with what Tom said about the beauty. I think it's the beauty of Ravel. Ravel was an interesting, another interesting composer because, of course, to some extent, many people just thought he almost was a one-hit wonder. People just thought of the Bolero, mm-hmm. who sort of tended to take over many, and certainly mine, in my narrow-minded way, as if that all Ravel was. And it is fascinating when you discover a composer, and it's often my hint to people about finding a way into classical music, which can sometimes seem intimidating, is to find a composer and then find out more and more about their music. And someone like Ravel, you can just keep going and finding more extraordinary pieces and more experiments he made and more collaborations he made, as much as he would be on his own with other artists. And there's something about the timing of Ravel and Debussy and Erik Satie, those great holy trio at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century in France, as they open up modern music and almost start to hint at jazz to come, the way that jazz and classical would feed into each other. And yes, absolutely, I find the magic of Ravel reminds you of the magic of music, something that in a world of streaming and in a world where music saturates us, that we sometimes take it for granted. There's something about immersing yourself in a composer like Ravel that reminds you of the spiritual power of music and how important it is, and absolutely that it can help you through dark and dangerous times. It seems to be music that's not a product or a product design. It's not a commodity. It is something very special, definitely has religious qualities. And also just that string quartet, his only string quartet, it therefore introduced me to the idea of the string quartet. Another way into classical music is find a format that you enjoy, like the string quartet, and discover the unbelievably myriad ways that composers have found to merge those four instruments and make them new. And Ravel only wrote, I like Debussy, only wrote the single quartet, but it is epic and endlessly fascinating, and one of those pieces of music that I could listen to every day again and again for the rest of my life because of its beauty, because of its surprise, and because of the extraordinary things it does with sound.
Ravel was very influenced by his mother's Spanish heritage and love of Spanish folk song. There is tension around Bolero. Can you explain a little bit about what that was about? Because Ravel said, I don't ask for my music to be interpreted, but only that it should be played.
Yeah. And I think Bolero is interesting because it is, yes, absolutely about tension. It's also music about music, which a lot of Ravel often was. It was about what you could do with music and how it reflected and came out of the imagination. It's almost pure imagination. And once you break through, again, some of the cliches of Bolero, it's an extraordinary piece. I say in the book, it's almost the jingle for Spotify. It's almost the perfect example of a perfect piece of music that builds its own tension and builds its own world and just keeps coming. And it chases its own tail as well. And you can hear some versions early on in the beginning of recorded music of Ravel playing it. And again, that breaks through some of the cliches of it being featured in commercial film, and you hear it as quite a sinister piece, quite a dangerous piece, and you realize again that sometimes you should be very careful about following the received wisdom about a composer and about a piece of music and find its own virtues.
I like that sound of that. Let's hear a little bit more of Bolero. We're exploring the past, present, and future of classical music with longtime journalist and author Paul Morley. Have you ever wanted to compose your own classical? Did you try? How did it go? Has your appreciation of classical music grown as you age? 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up on classical music with Paul Morley right after a news update on the Ideas Network. Claude Debussy's three-minute Syrinx, performed earlier this year by Amélie Brodeau of the Flute Channel on YouTube. We're appreciating classical music on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Syrinx is the Greek name for the folk instrument panpipes, composed by Debussy in 1913, now a standard in flute repertoire. Do you like solo pieces or a full orchestra sound? What do you want to know about the life and times of your favorite composer? 800-642-1234. We have music journalist Paul Morley's, whose new book is called A Sound Mind, How I Fell in Love with Classical Music and Decided to Rewrite Its Entire History. Paul, we heard from Lisa and Toma, who called in to share that they started listening to classical in their teens as a rebellion, believe it or not. No one else was listening to it, and Lisa still loves classical music and says, the violin can make Lisa cry. Yeah. What would you say to that?
Oh, absolutely. The cello especially gets me every time, solo cello music. And it is interesting that I've fallen in love with the string quartet and just hearing those four instruments, the power. You get spoilt when you growing up, you just listen to rock and pop and the power trio and amplified music. But it's a surprise when you realize how much intrinsic power an acoustic instrument has, and put together two violins, a viola and a cello. It's just the most extraordinary, ravishing sound. And it is interesting, that idea of falling in love with classical music as a rebellion in your teens when everyone else is listening to rock and pop, because that's what's occurred to me. What I love so much about classical music at the moment is when everybody is all going one way and the conversation always seems to be about the same thing. It's rather wonderful to find something of your own, to find some private moments, find something that hasn't been battered to death by everyone talking about it. So I find that listening to classical music seems as rebellious to me now as listening to the Velvet Underground and Iggy Pop did when I was in my teens. It seems more rebellious because you're finding a kind of secret passion, if you like, that you can have on your own. You can intensify your own kind of loneliness, if you like, especially at the moment, but also feel that you're sharing your loneliness with these great minds. And it feels like a radical act, whereas I think growing up, I often thought that listening to classical music was a conservative with a small C act, that it was actually a rather sort of a backward looking act. I now realize that it's in fact quite radical.
You tried composing a string quartet. How did that go?
Well, I started, making a documentary about how to be a composer for the BBC. And one of the things I decided I wanted to do is write a string quartet. I'd had experience making music in recording studios with electronic instruments, where you can make music without necessarily being a musician, by putting together noises and sounds and rhythms. I'd done that as part of a group called Art of Noise. But then I decided that I wanted to see if I could write my own piece of music. And I actually fell in love with the score, the idea of writing music down. It seemed such a unbelievably timeless thing, something that for a long time was the only way that music could be recorded and stored until recorded music, electronic music. Suddenly I realized that it would always be that way, that it was the most magnificent way of transmitting music as a kind of secret code through history. And I became very obsessed with the idea of writing music, not particularly good at it, but it certainly encouraged my wanting to find out more about classical music and these extraordinary composers that managed to write music in their head a lot of the time without necessarily hearing it until it was played. I thought that was fascinating, because in pop and rock, obviously, you're immediately hearing the sounds you're making, whereas a lot of classical music is made in the head, in the mind, and you don't necessarily know how it's going to sound until you heard it played. And I thought that was another insight into its magical qualities.
It's not just the composing history, but you also are studying the math in music and getting used to that mathematical element, which can be daunting. Did you wonder, as you put that together, what would happen to your critic's ear?
Yeah, absolutely. I was worried that it was a bit like a golfer changing their swing halfway through their career. I was worried that if I learned too much technical, I mean, it sounds daft that you can write about music without necessarily knowing anything technical about music. And to some extent, that's always upset composers, because they feel, how could you write about music when you don't know anything about music? Mm. But I was worried that it might infect me, if you like, that I knew something about the technical side of music, the notes and the rhythms and the score. But in fact, for me, it simply intensified something I was very keen on finding out about anyway, which was this history of a music that I knew, I didn't know how it fitted together. So finding out about the score and finding out about the history of classical music helped me put together a story, if you like, for my own purposes, about how classical music had developed over a few hundred years, and in a way enabled me to enjoy it more, because I didn't feel that I was blinded by it, or that I didn't understand the terminology, and I didn't understand how one composer followed another. So it was all part of an experience that enabled me, as I say in the title of the book, to actually rewrite its history for my own purposes, if you like, you know, creating almost a music scene of one, as if it was only for me, but hopefully through my own experience and finding out about it, it would help other people come to the music.
Talking with Paul Morley, who's been a music journalist for decades, and his book explores the world and history of classical music. It's called A Sound Mind, and you can join in on what classical music does to you, 800-642-1234. Mike is with us from Brookfield. Hi, Mike. What would you like to say about classical?
Hi. I just wanted to comment about Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, Sacra, when it premiered in Paris, and it was absolutely hated. The audience started booing and whistling and stomping. Stravinsky had written a piece that, to Parisians at the time, they just found it horrible. And I think it's a masterpiece. I was just wondering if your guest could comment on that.
Mike, thank you for that. What was happening there to Russian-born composer Igor Stravinsky?
Well, that period at the beginning of the 20th century is very interesting in the way that music was anticipating and reflecting, describing and defining changes that were going on in wider society, I guess, as electricity and the whole way that we lived lives, and speed and noise and sounds and automobiles, everything was changing so quickly, and the music was an instant soundtrack to it. It was a soundtrack to it before it even happened. I find that classical music is a place you often can find the first responses to major changes in life. And I think the idea that these composers like Stravinsky and Schoenberg and Webern were making sounds that reflected a modern world very, very quickly before people had got used to the modern world meant that the music sounded almost like it wasn't music. I mean, now it sounds definitely, because we're more used to music, it's influenced getting us used to those sounds. But at the time, it would have been the most shocking, alarming, disturbing sort of combination of sounds, because it was effectively responding to the modernization of the world itself and the way that we lived and the speed of things. So it was definitely shocking to those that were thinking that the music should be soothing and comforting, because suddenly it was a racket. It was noisy. It was upsetting. It was unconventional. Of course, all the stuff that I actually do like, and it's been a revelation for me to find out how much classical music has traditionally had those moments of reflecting great change and being incredibly innovative itself, to the extent that all great sort of innovative moments in music tend to emerge first of all in classical music and then spread out through jazz and pop and rock. Mm.
We have an email here from Jim in Cedarburg, who emailed to say that Paul McCartney wrote a symphony and it was roundly trashed. And Jim is wondering what the criticism was. McCartney has contributed several symphonies and wonders if you're if you have insights on the modern classical works by Paul McCartney.
Yeah, I think it's one of the difficulties that I've always found interesting, the resistance that people have to a fluidity between what we call genres, that if you do one thing, you're not allowed to do another. And most musicians, their instinct is that they want to move from one world to another. That's the way their mind works. They might be, you know, pigeonholed and put into a box as belonging to one world. But the better minds, I think, are always wanting to change. But the world almost doesn't allow it. It's almost like you're not allowed to move around. Even writing the book, from my position, it's been assumed that because I now enjoy classical music, that somehow I don't enjoy pop and rock, that I'm not allowed to, that you can only enjoy one and not the other. Whereas for me, the whole point should be that it mixes and merges. And I guess McCartney's instincts as a musician, you know, can't all be satisfied by just writing a certain sort of song. So he wants to break out and consistently, in a way that, you know, one of my favourite rock musicians who experimented with classical music, well, a few, but there would definitely be John Cale of the Velvet Underground and Brian Eno, who was originally in Roxy Music. Yeah. They wanted to move around through different genres so that they didn't just stay stuck in one style. And I guess the best musical minds prefer that. It's just something about the way that we like to lock everything into an alcove, if you like, that if you make one kind of music, you have to stay there.
I was thinking about you recently when I read the headline, Taylor Swift, a pop star done with pop, and that headline from the New York Times. And it was about her quarantine album, Folklore, but very much a departure from the past Taylor Swift. And so it seems as if musicians don't like to be put in that single box of one genre.
No, the curious musician is inevitably going to want to constantly experiment with what they do and almost would be bored themselves when they reach a certain point. You think of the great pop and rock musicians like David Bowie, I mean, constantly inventing and reinventing. Bob Dylan is constantly changing what he is. And even though it might not seem it, you know, there's a constant alteration in what they want to do with sound and the idea of a song. And I think that's definitely the case that is shared between the classical musician, the jazz musician and the pop musician. That if you are absolutely committed to music itself, you will be inventing and reinventing all the way through your career into your later years.
We're talking with music writer Paul Morley, who new work on classical music atop 600 pages, part history, part memoir. He writes, I used to think classical music was old-fashioned and out of date, but now I now realize it was just too modern. What was your epiphany on classical? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. That is British pianist, conductor, and composer Joanna McGregor on piano in Antiphonies from composer Sir Harrison Birtwistle. That performance in 2016, it is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have journalist Paul Morley, who calls Birtwistle the most astounding of all living composers. Still time to talk about classical music, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Pam now, joining us from Richland Center. Hi, Pam.
Hi. I just wanted to comment that I came to listening to classical music as a kid because I was into dance. And it's something I'd recommend as a way in is to move to music. I think makes you really appreciate it, especially during this pandemic. It's a great thing to do in your living room. So I encourage people to move to it. But I had two questions for him. One was when he was talking about modern sounds, I was thinking of Gershwin's American in Paris. And I don't know if that's considered classical music. But also he mentioned Erik Satie. And his Gymnopédie is one of my favorite pieces to move to. So I wondered if you could talk more about Erik Satie as well.
All right. Take it away, Paul Morley.
Wow. That's quite a challenge. Maybe it'd be better if I danced to it, but then you couldn't hear me. I mean, it is interesting, that idea of movement. A composer very influenced by Erik Satie, John Cage, who's got quite a reputation as being sort of almost anti-musical, oddly enough, he wrote some beautiful pieces for dance, great dance pieces. And it is interesting that you think of dance music and you tend to think of something with a consistent beat, and you think of commercial electronic dance music. But some of the great pieces, the Stravinsky's, the Eric Satie's, the John Cage's, John Cage writing for Merce Cunningham, they're exquisite pieces of music that absolutely your only response really is to move. I mean, I tend to move in the mind rather than physically, but I would still consider it dancing. And Eric Satie, the way that he invented a whole different, I mean, it was almost a response to the great bombastic symphonies, the Wagners of the 19th century, reducing music to this kind of intimacy, this very gentle, delicate opposition, if you like, to the big cathedrals of sound that almost reduced music so that it could begin again. And I always think that it's absolutely right that some of the great innovative pieces of classical music were often written to be danced to, ballets danced in that way, but also avant-garde dancing and the way that you could move your body. And therefore, the wonderful combining of sound and a body moving. There could be nothing more exquisite than that. Again, I think sometimes people just think of the more conventional ballet and the more conventional pieces, but there's some really unusual, strange, exotic pieces that compel the body to move in such wonderful ways. And for me, I would think, yeah, the best dance music is actually what we would call classical music, I think.
What can you tell, Pam, about George Gershwin and his place as a composer, whether it's An American in Paris, whether it's Rhapsody in Blue?
Yeah, I think it's another one of those elements of music being categorized.
Mm-hmm.
Because in a way, the best music and even the best classical music, it almost gets killed off by being given a name, by being given a label, as soon as it's called something. I mean, in a way, the benefit of Gershwin to some extent was that he wasn't called classical, that it could break free of that. So people weren't put off by it. You wonder if it was actually called classical music, which in many ways it could be called that and belongs in certain traditions and emerges out of and into Ravel himself. And Ravel was very fascinated by Gershwin. I think I'm always interested in trying to break free of some of this categorization. Duke Ellington, for me, could be easily called a classical composer. But again, it might put people off, you know, because they think it's going to be academic or too worthy, when in fact, really, it's just about exciting ways of working with sound and developing sound and working, using a way of using different instruments in a novel way. So I think Gershwin, for me, very much fits into a pattern that goes from, say, Ravel to Keith Jarrett and Herbie Hancock, in the way that Debussy leads to Miles Davis and music like that, you know. But because we're so used to putting it into compartments like jazz, classical, pop, it sometimes puts up barriers of entry. And I guess one of the reasons I wrote the book was to try and break down some of that and just try and move from one kind of music to another without worrying too much what it's necessarily called.
We're talking with Paul Morley, breaking down classical music, a music journalist for decades, and his new book is called A Sound Mind. Let's bring in Conrad now, who's joining us from Madison. Hi, Conrad.
Hi. I'm glad to be on this program. When I was growing up, my father, who's an engineer, not a musician, loved classical music. And this was like 40s to 60s and even 70s when I was in a home and with our siblings. And he would be playing Tchaikovsky, or his favorite pianist was Vladimir Horowitz. He'd be playing Shostakovich, and he always had the good stereo system, perhaps the latest stuff. And so a couple of months ago, I was listening to WFMT in Madison, and they played Danny Elfman's First Violin Concerto, which was just composed in 2019. It's called 1111. And I liked it a lot, and I bought the CD. And then I was talking with a musician, a friend of mine who is a musician, and I asked her what she thought about it. And she said, oh, yes, I know that. I think it's a little self-indulgent. So I'll leave you with that if you can comment on this kind of thing.
No, Conrad's trajectory in music starting with his father.
Yeah, I think everybody has a way in. I think if you're exposed to it at a young age in a more open-minded way, I think that will carry you through all your life. I wasn't, so I've had to find my own idiosyncratic route into it, you know, and find out some things that you might have found as a younger age if it was just surrounding you as you grew up. I think it's interesting that idea of self-indulgent. You know, I would hope that it is self-indulgent. I think these words are used sometimes to put people off, but a great piece of music that comes from the self and is about the self, it might be called self-indulgent. What it really means is it's incredibly personal, incredibly powerful. It's an incredibly individual statement. And in a funny sort of way, the better it is, the more self-indulgent it is in a good way.
You've been grappling with mortality and realizing you're not the music journalist of your 20s when the music will go on forever and seemingly you will too. And you've been thinking about, what is that farewell song? What is that epitaph song? The song you depart this earth with. What have you come in that journey, in that realization?
Well, yeah, I didn't want it necessarily to be too morbid. But it was something that was interesting to me, just in terms of how, when I was in my 20s and 30s, the idea of listening to music, I always thought that for the rest of my life I would be listening to the same sort of music, the Joy Divisions and the Bob Dylans and the Captain Beefhearts. And to an extent I am, but I'm also listening to all this other music. And it occurs to me that a lot of this other music was written by composers who were still writing music in their later years, whether that was a Mozart and a Schubert, where their later years were still relatively young, or a Beethoven and a Shostakovich, where they would be writing music when they were more conventionally old. And I was just fascinated by this idea of constantly being alive and having energy when you're in your later years. And the Beethoven late quartets, which were extraordinary pieces of music that he was writing towards the end of his life, Shostakovich's later work when he's in his 70s. I just thought it was fascinating that they were still working forwards, they were still progressing, they still had the energy to want to face up to things, even as they were ending their life. And I suppose as a listener, I wanted to think the same, that I would be still having the energy to listen to new music, even if I was coming to the end of my life. I wasn't being nostalgic and trying to sentimentally recreate my teenage years. And I started to think, well, possibly the music I will listen to in my later years will be that music written by Beethoven and Shostakovich and Elliot Carter when they were old. And it seems to still have incredible sense of youth, even though to some extent you are old, but it has energy. It has a belief in the future. It has a hope for the future. And that felt more inspiring to me than just going back and listening to music I used to listen to when I was a teenager.
Paul, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Paul Morley is a longtime music journalist and critic. His book is called A Sound Mind, How I Fell in Love with Classical Music and Decided to Rewrite Its Entire History. Just ahead, it's 1A. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.